Are you ready for a front seat to the future of finance? Look no further than UK Finance Digital Innovation Summit 2023. Join us on October the 31st in the City of London at 155 Bishopsgate and gain insights that will set you apart. Visit our website today at ukfinance.org.uk/DIS2023.
You're listening to the Future of Finance podcast by UK Finance, a series exploring the latest trends in financial services, how they're changing, and how firms can equip themselves to face the challenges of tomorrow.
Welcome to the Future Finance podcast series. I'm Bryony Krikorian-Slade, Principal for Payments and Innovation at UK Finance, and today we'll be considering the future of payments. UK Finance publishes an annual report of how much is paid around the UK, how and by whom. 45 billion payments are made in the UK annually across 10 different payment rails, which have different owners and participants. This covers everything from large-scale purchases like individuals buying a house to government paying regular benefits like child maintenance. Today we're going to consider what is in store for the payments landscape in the UK. How are the major rails evolving or being completely overhauled? Who is responsible for these changes and for enabling innovation to flourish? And are we as an industry ensuring future consumer and business needs will be met? I'm joined by Paul Horlock, Chief Payments Officer from Santander, and Hamish Thomas, Partner at Deloitte. Welcome. And Hamish, let me turn to you first. We've been working together on the UK Finance response to the Future Payments Review, commissioned by the Chancellor and taken forward by Joe Garner, to look at whether customer needs are being met and how we compare to global payment markets. Can you talk us through the key findings of our response and how we reach them?
Sure. Thanks very much, Brian, and thanks for having me. I think probably it's first worth saying that the UK Finance work started in advance of the announcement of the Chancellor's review. I think it's quite important in terms of the recognition by UK Finance and the members that it would be worthwhile looking at the way forward for payments in the UK, particularly with respect to the significant portfolio of initiatives that are already underway. I think it's probably pretty good timing that it sort of overlapped with the call for input from the Chancellor's review being led by Joe Garner. I think from review perspective, also important to note kind of the breadth and depth of inputs. So clearly a lot of input from members. Obviously, you're aware that pretty significant working group task force set up by UK Finance with membership from across members, large and small, to provide inputs, listen to concerns and reach some consensus on what the position of UK Finance may be. And then that was augmented with pretty broad global research from various sources to give us confidence in the positions that we take and the evidence base that we could feed in. But when we look at the work done, I guess some of the headline findings break up into three principal areas. One is around probably the most important in terms of service to customers. So what are customers getting? Where might there be some room to do more? And where are things potentially working pretty well? Second, the role of regulation. And then thirdly, when we look at infrastructures themselves, clearly there's a lot of work going on, which is taking a lot of industry bandwidth. I think perhaps one of the more important things to recognise so far is when we look at the various use cases for payments in terms of people paying businesses, businesses paying people, payments to and from government, for example, all those use cases are served. But there was more we could do in certain areas. Second to note, protection of consumers remains a priority. I think it's important to remember that in the context of, for example, technical innovation, and also when we make international comparison, which is if we look at the protections that are in place for consumers when they use a card, for example, versus other payment types, or indeed consumer protections in the UK as compared to other markets. It's an important point to look at whilst we also look at, for example, things like technical innovation. Where are we today in the UK? What's our starting point for our next wave of development, our next wave of innovation? In the UK, there's a mature market where the use cases that we need, as I said earlier, are supported in terms of moving money around. But a very mature cards market, for example, we've had faster payments for over 10 years. And they're quite important context points when one compares that to another country that may have a starting point relatively recently of having a very cash-dependent economy, which is looking perhaps to leapfrog when it comes to digital payments with perhaps strong government intervention to move people off cash. And that also perhaps leads us into regulation. Clearly, there is a role for robust regulation, the appropriate controls to be in place to protect and maintain a sustainable, secure, safe, and importantly, trusted financial system, and in particular, payments infrastructure. And it's generally recognised that that's, broadly speaking, what we have in the UK, which is great. And I think that is a very positive facet. That being said, I think it's also important to recognise that when we look at innovation and possibility, there's a balance to be struck between the outcomes that the regulators are seeking to deliver and the level of prescription when it comes to how those are delivered. And then perhaps a final word on infrastructure. So, you know, the roadmap, whether it's about MPA, experimentation with CBDC, ongoing open banking, there's a whole raft of initiatives that has implications for how we evolve the payments estate. That's a very big book of work, and there's a limited amount of time and capacity to deliver some of those changes. That's one thing that needs to be continually reviewed, most importantly in the context of the resilience, the robustness of the industry, which is to say, if you deliver lots of change all at once, that does increase the level of risk that one puts into the system, and being very clear on how we manage that. Because obviously rule number one from a payment system is it keeps working, the money keeps flowing, it underpins the trust in the economy and commerce more broadly. Payments are the connective tissue of financial services and commerce more broadly and underpin the economy. So keeping that safe and secure is clearly an important fundamental that we need to be very mindful of as we deliver a significant level of change over the next 3, 5, and 10 years. So I guess those are some of the headlines that particularly spring to mind for me, but you know, you may have some observations or perhaps Paul, something for you.
Well, thanks, Hamish. As you say, there's a lot going on. and it is a very crowded, quite sometimes confusing marketplace in terms of development. And I think the big challenge for us as a high street bank in particular is that risk concentration. The more you change things, the more you're exposed to risk and the more you see challenges for consumers. And you mentioned in particular customer protection. And if we look back, cast our minds back 15 years, you know, we drove to implement faster payments at the time, kind of a world-leading solution for what we were asked to do. But the context has moved on. You know, you couldn't buy a car on eBay when Faster Payments was launched. You can now. Well, actually, you can buy a picture of a car on eBay. The car isn't normally there. And that's part of the issue that we're seeing with APP scams, that the context of commerce and people's expectations has moved on from some of the solutions that we provided. And it's concentrated really hard on how do we protect customers? How do we get safe and secure? And how do we make sure this huge mass of activity is concentrated and delivered to get the best investment and outcome value for customers and businesses?
That's really helpful context for this specific point in time. Obviously, we've been involved in the Future Payments Review, but Hamish, as you said, we've been considering these things as an industry and what to do about this congested landscape and how to address that issue around capacity and budget for firms and resilience and risk management. So you also touched on innovation. Let's focus in, as we did in our response, on one particular area for innovation, person to business or P2B. Around 35 billion payments in the UK are made in the P2B space. So that's everything from retail shopping to paying your bills. It's seen a huge amount of innovation in the last two decades. In shops, we've seen changes from chip and PIN 20 years ago to contactless 15 years ago, and then mobile pay in various forms 10 years ago. Online, we've seen the growth of marketplace platforms, which you mentioned, and payment platforms serving those marketplaces like Shopify, Stripe, and many others. And we've also seen in-app payments proliferating from the use of QR codes for tips to Klarna allowing customers to split their purchases in installments. And all of these innovations, or many of them, are intended to remove friction and ease the customer experience and really embed it within the retailer flow, if you like. The Future Payments Review questioned whether we're doing enough to allow innovation to flourish in the UK. You talked, Hamish, a little bit about the different starting points for different countries around the world. So you've got the UPI in India, starting from a point of very heavy cash usage, and then the enablement of the digital ID, pushing forward rapid growth of the UPI, and then Pix in Brazil has been another comparator we've been looking at. Are there barriers to innovation in P2B, specifically in the UK? Is innovation in and of itself desirable if it's not meeting a customer need? Is there need to do more on this? Paul?
First things, Brian, thanks for asking me to be on the podcast. The innovation of a podcast I like because I've got a face for radio. So podcasts are my thing. I like innovation. We all like innovation. But innovation for the sake of innovation is actually quite a dangerous thing. We've been doing a lot of work over the last period to look at what is it that customers really want. And when you look at the recent evidence, particularly from a business perspective, in the current cost of living context that we have, both businesses and customers are looking for value. They're not just looking for speed. Actually, when we asked Age UK about this a few years ago, they want slower payments, not faster payments. They wanted the right friction in a payment to make sure it was safe and were able to transact in the way that they wanted to. So it's what's appropriate. What is innovation can bring to make sure that customers get that value and businesses really get what they're looking for. Open banking is a great example, right? Open banking, a number of us were there from the start. We had a number of drivers. PSD2 was a key driver. The CMA came in with clear expectations of what they wanted to do to improve competition in the banking sector. I guess the challenge was some of the requirements and some of the needs weren't actually in pace with some of the things that we were then asked to do. We've had some opportunities out there for a few years now that really haven't necessarily caught fire. But we always tend to overestimate in the short term and underestimate the long term. This thing will move, I've no doubt about it, but it's making sure you get that trigger use case. And we've seen that in things like contactless in the UK. And what really took off for contactless was use in transit, that ability to just walk straight through, to tap straight through at the gates. Suddenly opened up a whole bunch of opportunities in the way that we could use that technology. And I think that moment's coming for open banking. There are simple deliveries being brought now by high street banks in particular around being able to pay me very quickly or pay your credit card very quickly. And it's the scale that brings it. You know, there's been lots of niche use cases out for some time, but the scale benefit, as we saw in transit and we'll see in some of those big open banking opportunities, is what brings the opportunity to really start to use those innovations. Hamish also mentioned regulation. I'm not sure if regulation is a brake or an accelerant in some of this activity. There's a lot of push for us to innovate. The challenge comes when you get into the whole control mechanisms and order mechanisms and other requirements of regulations. We tend to do what's only necessary to meet the regulation. We don't always tend to think, what can we do to get past it or what can we do to create the opportunity? And in some cases, I think that regulatory oversight has slowed the process down. And actually for customers, they haven't seen the benefit quick enough in some of those areas. If the market had been allowed to just develop in its own right, and a great example is the blueprint. As an industry, we developed the blueprint back, 6 years ago now. And we were of the view that that blueprint needed to evolve rapidly, but organically in terms of the overlay services that would arrive for customers. We've been very slow in seeing some of those overlays because we've not been able to pursue the speed of delivery in some of the core foundation services that would allow it. And that's been really bound up in some of that regulatory governance activity. So innovation, we definitely want to see. We want to see value for customers. We want to make sure that we're aligned in the way we deliver it. But I think the market's got to drive it. And if the market can drive it, actually then value becomes the driver between the way that it delivers for the market and customers.
Just to add that point on value and therefore the use cases we're solving for, particularly the scale use cases, because I think it's absolutely correct. And that perhaps leads me back to something I mentioned earlier, which is this notion of innovation is often closely associated with what can we do next with technology. And you get in this almost like technology arms race where it says, well, country X or organization Y is doing A, B, or C with new technology. So it could be QR codes somewhere out in the Asia Pacific, for example, often cited. And I think we need to keep ourselves anchored in what are the right things to invest in and to deliver for the value to end customer. And that brings you back to the context point, which I won't repeat, but it's, you know, the important point. I think, and related to that is when we look at, you know, specifically asked about P2B. And part of the challenge on that one I found, and obviously we saw that when we were doing the review with you, is that a lot of the mind share emphasis is on the P part of that, which is to say individuals and their options for paying for things, whether it's a utility bill or in a shop on an e-commerce platform, which of course is very important. I think it is equally important to think about the retailer end of this. Because what came through quite strongly is some of the challenges are perhaps more faced by merchants and the options they have or not for an acceptance perspective. What might they need to accept in the future and how to manage that? In some cases, the time to value, so somebody will pay for something in their shop, but actual cash flow might take, you know, a number of days, for example. And these are all real challenges. And then the example of fraud and security authentication and the extent to which that might create a degree of hesitation or dropout in e-commerce journeys. So I think it's important we look at these innovations and that the best way forward, there's both the P and the B side of P2B. Yeah. And much of, I think, the innovation opportunity or the advancement opportunity is increasing levels of choice and optionality on the merchant end of that transaction.
And it is about that choice you're talking about. And it's a trade-off of choice you want to make in terms of things like customer protection, speed, flow through of liquidity. We always have this debate about the UK having a different context and the fact that we have a very mature card market and customers can do most of the transactions that we talk about in some of those other countries actually easily from a card perspective. Mm-hmm. But then we get into the cost position. We understand what the merchant may have to pay, what runs through the end-to-end system. But let's be clear, that helps pay for that customer protection. And a wholesale run without really learning those lessons and building a customer protection mechanism and ecosystem and value-based ecosystem, actually we run into a whole new bunch of problems and we really don't want to go there. So we've got to be clear how we get the right development of innovation that serves customers and business as well. And you've got to look at both sides of that equation. I completely agree.
Yeah, absolutely.
And from UK Finance perspective, you know, having run the strong customer authentication program for e-commerce changes, and then also the contactless limit changes from 30 to 45 to 100, we know how important it is to engage the retailer base. And our evidence found 99% of private businesses are SMEs. They've got investment cycles to think about, hardware and software from a payment perspective comes at a cost. So they need to be convinced that any retailer payment use case is going to be valuable for them to make that investment and also to change their communications to customers. That's also a key part that we've seen in both the SEA and contactless programs, that you have to communicate clearly in order to influence behavioral change. So before we leave this question on innovation in the person-to-business space, let's talk a little bit about enablers. Is there more we can ask for from government, for example, on digital ID to enable these innovations, these use cases to be met? Paul?
I think we've said, you know, regulation could be a brake or an accelerant. And I think a clear policy position can be an accelerant. We've seen it in other countries. We've seen where there's been a driver to move to a more digital economy. We've seen drivers in Scandinavia where the use of digital ID drove a more digital way of enacting and enabling transactions. And I think we've got good evidence, I think, around the global marketplace that that kind of driver really helps drive focus on what we can deliver. And actually, with digital ID, it starts to open up a number of different opportunities around those transactions for, well, request to pay is a great example. Request to pay has kind of been languishing a bit. It's one of those things that came out of all the work we did on the payment strategy forum. And it was really part of the blueprint conversation. And the blueprint, for those that maybe can't recall back that far, was something that we drew up as what we thought the ecosystem looked like. We understood what we thought the foundations were in terms of, you know, the Bank of England providing that ability to settle. We've got a clearing and settlement engine above. We've then got overlays that provide new ways for customers to engage with that capability. And then we move into the channels and deliveries to customers. And that request to pay was one of those services we saw as crucial in that area because it brought the ability for customers to engage in making payments in a way that's far more controllable for them, gave them different options, gave them a chance to take control of their own liquidity, if you like, in the way that maybe a direct debit doesn't. Now, Pay UK came up with the standards for a request to pay probably about 3 years or so ago now, but we've seen a bit of a reluctance in the vendor community to bring some of those capabilities to market. And I think one of the things that holds that back is the lack of a digital ID, which allows customers to engage in some of those end-to-end processes with more confidence and allows businesses to engage with more confidence to run those repositories because they know then who customers really are and could connect the different parts of the value journeys. So that as an enabler is crucial. I think moving forward with other open banking capabilities is crucial. We've seen just how useful some of those changes can be. Confirmation of payee, we built on the back of the open banking directory capability. Let's look at what confirmation of payee has done in terms of improving confidence customers around those, what were previously misdirected payments, what actually became a bigger problem within the APP scan world. The chance to be absolutely sure about how that payment's going has actually made such a difference. That's been such an enabler to where we're going. It actually plays a bit again to the ID question, but it's used the data that's currently available in those banks, and those institutions to really provide customers more confidence. So I think that's important. Confidence is important. Trust is important. You know, pretty obvious things when it comes to banking, but the ability to enable them and put them for customers' use in those transactions really makes such a big difference.
Yeah, I think perhaps just to build on and agree with that, really, if we look at what we found during the work to write this roadmap report, is that the integration of digital ID with payments infrastructures, then alongside, for example, wallets, you know, account-to-account propositions, ideally with the right levels of protection, as we discussed earlier, do lead to, you know, improvements in some of the journeys, particularly in the P2P and B2B space, for example. And in some countries where we've seen those taken off, again, just really agreeing with Paul, is the role of government has driven change and pace of adoption. including either being early adopters themselves or sort of like underwriting the launch of some of these services, or indeed promoting those services and pushing wider adoption. So is there more we can do? I think the answer to that question is absolutely yes. More broadly, as opposed to taking one thing in particular. But I think we always have to come back to, you know, what are we solving for? I think the general view is having a digital ID will be useful, and I agree with that. I think giving it the context of the journeys it would prove, or the protections it would improve, or the access that it would improve, is the way to have a positive discussion as to how we move forward with digital identity, and indeed a number of other innovations.
I do think that on the digital ID front, there's a bit of a danger. We're waiting for that big set piece moment, you know, and I remember sitting in a previous role where I was asked to say, is payments the way through for digital ID? Yes and no. And I think if we'd sat the whole requirement on the payments industry, we were creating a rod for our own back on top of everything else we had to do. I think there is, again, a really good argument for clear policy and let the market deliver. And we're starting to see market solutions now appear in the digital ID space. If you set standards and expectation, it allows the market to then innovate to those standards. We can then work and interoperate with each other. That's where I think we're going to go with this one, because that's what's going to give it a chance to evolve. And actually value then tends to drive it, because you'll find competitive opportunities, commercial opportunities to drive the delivery for benefit of those consumers and businesses. That's going to drive the adoption. If we wait for one set piece environment, one set piece delivery, where we all have to line ourselves up, the histories tend to be, we tend to move at the speed of the slowest. We tend to deliver at the constriction of the least able. We're not going to get the best delivery for customers on that basis.
That's interesting perspective. So we're not looking here for a government-backed intervention. It sounds like we're happy with market pace evolution.
I think it's policy that clear view of where we're going as a country or as a market, and we can then be clear what we expect the market to innovate with. Setting standards, setting direction and clarity is crucial, but then let people innovate. Mm. That's really where we need to start moving to.
I think that clarity point is also important from an adoption perspective. Now, as individuals or businesses, to echo Paul, the trust point is really important. Trust comes with understanding, and having clarity on where we're going and how we can get there with something like digital ID allows for that clarity of communication. The point you were making actually in terms of merchants helping their customers understand what some of these new things look like and why they're good and why it's a good idea to use them. If there's ambiguity in the mix as to how some of these things are going to develop, then that, I think, would make people reticent in terms of their adoption, which sort of then slams the brakes on, which creates the problem.
Great. We've talked about P2B use cases, so both retailers in store, but also the paying of utility bills, et cetera, and request to pay is a clear innovation there. Other journeys where we're seeing existing innovation of interest, or we could see innovation in the future, so government to business, tax payments, subscription payments, rent, any of those areas, are they ripe for innovation?
Potentially all of the above. They're all quite broad sets of types of payment. I think one thing we haven't really talked about today, which is worthy of note, is variable recurring payments, so VRPs, and where they may go. Clearly, they have a sort of bit of a leading use case at the moment for where next with open banking. And I think they are both interesting and important, both in terms of how we deliver them, in terms of the balance between regulatory direction and the market deciding and moving things forward, but also actually what they do in providing a degree of choice to those who may not be comfortable with existing methods of payment, such as direct debit. And that flexibility, that optionality, that sense of control, which I mean way back since, I guess, when we originally did the PSF work, and I think it holds true today, some of the nervousness around direct debit is the fact that it's pretty hard-coded. So it's on this day, this amount, and the level of control in sort of close to the payment with respect to its amount and timing is not where some people need it to be in terms of how they manage their financial affairs, their cash flow. So the VRPs, I think, has real potential to include more people's ability to use new forms of digital payment, you know, and equally to help them make better use of financial services in terms of savings and current accounts and the move towards providing some sort of sweeping type capability for individuals.
I think that plays back to the value question, doesn't it?
Yes.
You know, it goes back again to the innovations. We had a great innovation in the UK called Payem, right, that we delivered from a P2P perspective. And it's a conversation, though, that Joe Garner has asked as part of the review is, you know, what are the P2P solutions in the UK? And other countries have developed some of the innovations back on that P2P requirement. Let's be frank. We had issues around the data delivery. We had issues around some technology. We had issues around the ubiquity of it. But the challenge again was, if customers really, really needed a new P2P solution, I think it would have got more time and space and attention. actually, we have some pretty good P2P solutions, and it's not one of the biggest needs out there. Is it something that really drives value? Probably not. You take some of the use cases where we can really drive the cost of transmitting money down with the flexibility and the openness to be able to mix channels, then you start to create some real opportunities for those businesses and for customers to make those purchases. And I think that's going to come through with some of the things that, that Hamish has just been talking about, but also from banking itself, when you start to look at the flexibility then of standing on top of those payment rails and opening new opportunities, that's where we're going to find some new innovations around serving that part of the market that really needs more value. But I totally agree, you know, the challenge of direct debits work very well. You know, for those customers that want them and need them and sign the mandate and just don't worry about it, you know, the guarantee works fantastically. The ability for businesses to be able to manage their rolls of transactions, their batch transactions effectively is excellent. The fact that banks have more control actually for that 3-day cycle, with the payments that executes on the right date, but we get more chance to deal with any issues that arise, which you don't get in real-time payments. So there is a need for a mix of type of payment for the specific need of the transaction to get the best control and get the best value. We shouldn't throw the baby out of the bathwater. Yeah. Some of the things we've always done, we've done for a very good reason. We have to look at the value opportunities with some of those new options coming through.
So it is about diversity of choice as well. Can I ask then, how should we balance that kind of inclusivity of different payment types with the increasing need to focus on sustainability going forward, particular, I guess, with the view to cash and access to cash?
Cash is always the tough one. I knew we'd come to cash at some point in this conversation. We have been a little obsessed in the UK with access to cash for good reason. I totally understand why. But I also see customers that are often caught in the cash economy paying the price. I think we have a responsibility to provide them with options which are better long-term value for them. And I think, again, you'll see other countries that have made a statement about moving to a digital economy really driving those solutions for customers. We have a tendency in the UK to try and be everything to everybody. As helpful as that might sound, it doesn't help us with the best delivery, but it means often we'll run a number of different programs, sometimes in conflict with each other, to come to an outcome which dissipates and dilutes the value we can bring to customers. I mean, a really good example of today, you know, we've got a conversation going on around digital cash that's been driven by the bank, I think absolutely rightly, that says, what should the digital pound look like? And we're in the middle of a big conversation about how could we do that either with central bank money or with commercial bank money. But at the same time, we're driving the delivery of new payment architecture, which sits on that, you know, how do we deliver the blueprint conversation? Well, that MPA conversation started 6 years ago in a context which was different. We've got to be talking now what's right for the customers within a cost of living crisis, within a set of different transaction needs, within a set of different fraud environments that sit out there. And so how do we actually meet that by looking at the discussion that's been brought up by the bank with the orders we've been trying to act on for the last 6 years or so? The outcome may be different than we thought it was 2 or 3 years back. But we have to be pragmatic and open to a conversation about how do we get that fused together? Because if we're going to invest hundreds of millions as an industry, we've got to do it for the right outcome, not for several outcomes that actually dilutes the value of that investment.
And I think perhaps related to that point, I think we haven't talked much about interoperability. So this sort of parallel development of infrastructure, all of which, you know, as programs of work in and of themselves are pretty sensible. Some of them are exploratory right now. But as we look to whichever end state or medium term position that we want the industry to get to, it's important to consider that there's sort of there's an amount of digital payment volume. There's a set of infrastructures which are provide options for how we do that, which is arguably good, but then raises question about the commercial sustainability of having multiple infrastructures doing very similar things, and how do we manage that as an industry in terms of the benefit and the value delivery, whilst there's a huge amount of investment that goes into enabling some of these new modes of transfer, which I think comes back to Paul's point, which is to say, we have something that started a number of years ago, and the context has changed. It's good practice to continue to revisit where we are, where we had it. Have some of the assumptions changed? Has the context changed? Is what we're delivering flexible to those changes? And if not, what is the right course of action? Whether it's about emergence of new technologies, emergence of new payments types, and a need to make things as easy and value-driven for end customers, both, the consumers of payments, is very important. And I think, you know, reflecting on some of the conversations that we had about the roadmap, you know, during this period of work, there is a lot going on. And each of those initiatives, when looked at in and of themselves, it has inherent value. I guess one of the big questions for the industry is, when you bring these things together, are there ways that we look at that roadmap that it could be improved in terms of how it delivers value, how it manages risk, and where it's coherently going to be taking us?
And let's be frank, when we worked on the blueprint over 6 years ago now, we weren't having a conversation about smart money.
No.
Right? Whereas now, I think the whole digital pound conversation is talking about, how do we bring money closer to the transaction? How do we get to that point of creating things like opportunities like atomic settlement? How do we get to then move asset and value at the same time? That wasn't a conversation when we started talking about the way the MPA would work. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think we can change everything overnight, because you talked earlier about the investment cycles for SMEs, the way that we're invested in some of the things that we do. And we have done for many, many years. But we have to then think sensibly about, where is the new technology going to take us? Where does the new opportunity take us? And therefore, actually, how do we create the right segmentation, the right understanding, use the roadmap that we've been working on as an industry to say, how do we get the best cadence of delivery over time to get to the right outcome? We just cannot pursue what we'd signed up to do blindly to that need for joining that strategic coherence together.
I guess that brings us to our recommendations in our report. And one of those is to have a clearer direction from government and coordinated engagement between government, regulators and industry. Are we talking about a vision? Are we talking about a plan or a policy statement, as you've called it, Paul?
I think lots of us have talked about how you do this, because we don't necessarily want to have another big strategy forum, right? Because that was damn hard work, I can tell you now, actually. but what we are concerned about is, we do great things like that, come up with a really good vision of where we're going to go. But often then we'll resurface 6 years later and say, so have we hit the strategy? It's that ability to set clear policy and then check against the progress against that strategy to make sure we course correct, to make sure we understand, is it delivering? And if it's not, what are we going to do about it? Means actually we would then be able to draw these initiatives together and get some coherence about the way we're delivering. That does require really clear and open conversations between government and industry and business and customers. And it needs to be an ongoing conversation of some sort. I don't think any of us know the answer of how, but we know there's been a gap. We know there's been a lack of that ability to measure since we came out with that vision a number of years ago. We haven't really had that collective ability to say, are we on track? And if we're not, what are we going to do about it?
And I think, you know, on a related point, things happen in the time, whether it's about new technologies or indeed new regulatory needs, which are absolutely valid. So, for example, consumer duty wasn't on the horizon absolutely. When we did the original the blueprint work over many years ago. And therefore, if you have this slightly more coherent joined up approach, then it does allow for the way in which some of these new things that are necessary, the impact of those can be assessed, whether it's about the way in which we deliver, when we deliver, how we release most value, and indeed, you know, do things need to change? Because, you know, looking at the roadmap, you look down the list of things on there, and they all have value. Consumer duty, obviously, the extension of confirmation of payee. We look at, you know, mandatory reimbursement from a fraud perspective, which is a big conversation how that gets executed, but is seeking to protect customers, which is, you know, fundamentally, you know, a good thing, all the way through to some of the wider, you know, PSR reviews, etc. When you bring all this together as individual initiatives, you look at those and go, I understand why that's there. Could we always say with confidence, I understand how it links into everything else and how it's coherently taking us to where we're going? I think that's the big question that we need to seek to resolve. And it was one of the key findings of the work that was done with the UK Finance members.
I guess a final thought is, and you talked a bit about this, Hamish, is how do we bring other actors into that discussion and into that shared vision? And there are, you know, particular touch points for this, like fraud, for example, but also, or prevention of fraud, but also enabling particular technology like mobile payments. How do we bring those players into the discussion more so that we can achieve this sort of end vision of good customer outcomes?
We're both sat here pointing at each other. I think, one of the brilliant things the Payment Strategy Forum did is it did just that, actually. It brought big business into the room. It brought consumer groups into the room. It brought vendors into the room and banks and other PSPs. You know, that was great in terms of getting that reach. And the groups actually got even more complex ever since. You know, one of our big challenges around APP is, how do we bring big tech into that conversation? Because that's the channels now people are using to come into those type of transactions. That has to be driven in a way that allow all the players to come in and have another joined up conversation. There's probably only one or two areas that corral that group. And I guess that goes back to our policy statement again. It goes back to being able to get clarity for the market about where we want to go, and then make sure we can involve the people in the conversation.
I think a good point on communications. I mean, when we did the strategy forum work, it was great to see a community. In order to deliver some of the positive outcomes we're seeking, some of the improvements we're seeking, it simply can't be done if one sits wholly inside the perimeter of, I guess, traditional, quote unquote, financial services. And then takes to Paul's point about, you know, who has the ability to corral some of those groups together. There's obviously a balance to be struck in terms of how that's delivered when looking at the role of government, regulator, industry participants, both FS and non-FS. But the first point is for everyone to understand that does need to happen if, from an end-to-end perspective, we want to address some of the detriments we see and or deliver some of the beneficial outcomes that we are collectively seeking.
Thanks for listening to the UK Finance Future of Finance podcast. For more information, please visit ukfinance.org.uk/podcasts.